So we've got Josh Wilson here. We're going to push break back to 2:30. So Josh is going to come up. Josh has been doing some great media work around the Bay Area, founded the nonprofit Independent Arts and Media. And he's going to come up and speak for the last 5 minutes before break. There's a great quote that I saw in one of Josh's emails that that he took from Scoop Nisker. He said, if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own. So I like that a lot. That'll give a little framing for Josh's. So come on up, Josh. Thanks.
Folks, I'm super sorry I'm late. Not just because I'm delaying your break, but also because I missed everybody else's speeches, and I didn't just come to say things, but also to hear and listen, so I apologize. So my work in the cultural realm is via an organization called Independent Arts and Media, which proposes, it's a nonprofit, which proposes to empower producers locally to create their own culture outside of institutional power structures. So when Cheyenne contacted me about this conference discussion on resisting militarism, that quote from Scoop Nisker came to mind, if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own. More specifically, if the culture is displeasing, make a new one. And that's very easily said. But at Indie Arts, we look to punk and DIY culture as our inspiration. And that stated, of course, punk and DIY culture is not exactly or always nonviolent. I was at a rock show last night, and there was the usual core group of macho so-and-sos throwing their elbows around in the mosh pit. And at that show, there was a threshold of hostility that nevertheless wasn't crossed. And the line between aggressive physicality and the intent to harm is not always so clear. The larger issue, I think, that we're dealing with is the fact that humans are basically savage primates with existential dilemmas. What does that mean for us, and what does it mean for the difference between our primal origins and our lofty ideals as an evolved species? Maybe we can take it down to the very ground level and look at that most natural of evolutionary activities, sex. And sexuality, based in the sense of touch, is one of the primary wellsprings of sophisticated aesthetic in humans. Along with taste and hearing and vision, sex produces rhapsodies and sublime passions of the heart, soul, and mind. And yet, as Perry Farrell noted, sex is violent. Which brings us to the topic of Abu Ghraib. That was clearly a massive example of America's non-consensual sexual dysfunction. The literal rape of another culture, captured in photographs. Susan Sontag wrote that, quote, those photographs are us. Abu Ghraib goes way deep into our culture and is all about militarism and power. It is different from what's called play in the... It's different from what's called play amongst the sadomasochistic subcultures, which emphasize consensuality and permission. And permission and consent are not words one associates with jail or militarism. So how can it be that there is a culture of sexuality around sadomasochism that plays with the trappings of power and non-consensuality, yet can remain entirely consensual and even positive explorations of human potential, depending on who you ask? And how is that relevant to our own understanding and navigation of militarism in our culture? And there are two things I want to offer on that regard. First is, let me recommend you do more reading on the topic, if not exploring. Samuel R. Delaney, one of the few African-American science fiction writers, or at least one of the few who made it big, wrote a remarkable series of books called Neverion, which are equal parts swords and sandals, pulp fiction, and there's also an epistemological treatise on the origins of human knowledge. It happens 5,000 years before the pyramids were built. And it's also an exploration of consent, power, sexuality, and slavery. And in it, the leader of the first slave revolt in human history, a former slave himself, is in a consensual BDSM relationship with another former slave. And it's not titillating or smutty stuff. It's actually a great adventure story and also a total metafictional literary stunt. And it's very intellectually digressive in its exploration of the issues of power and consent. So Neverion by Samuel R. Delaney, go check that out. Second, let's look at what exactly is meant by the word militarism. Broadly, let's describe it as a culture and system of discipline around the use of force and the execution of violence for a specific purpose. The nature of that purpose is key. Merriam-Webster describes militarism as the exaltation of the military class and its ideals, and also the exaltation of military virtues and ideals. This issue of virtue and idealism is very important, and in my non-expert opinion, I'm just an editor. The whole issue is one of fealty to and interpretation and practice of those virtues and ideals. Consider a military force that robs from the rich and gives to the poor. Robin Hood. What's not to like? Everyone loves that. Okay, now how about Pol Pot and Stalinism? The gap between the ideals, the militaristic idealism and virtue of organized power systems and sometimes bloody reality is vast. War toys are another great example. I used to use war toys as a kid. Who had cool war toys when you were little? Mine were Micronauts and Star Wars and lightsabers. Totally cool lightsabers. And you know, if you think they're not cool, you will never win an argument about that with a 14-year-old. There's not a chance. So when do war toys stop being toys? When is aspiring to be a Jedi Knight while your pal is Darth Vader and your 14-year-old school gaming okay, and when does it cross the line? What's the difference between the ideal of the paladin, the noble soldier and warrior of truth and justice, beating back the Nazis, and perhaps giving one's own life in the process, as opposed to the mirrored reality of My Lai, or Abu Ghraib, or the pogroms, or the Shoah, or the killing fields, or Gaza, or a Hamas suicide bomber in a Jerusalem commuter bus? What about that good guy, bad guy dualism? Who gets to be the hero and the villain? And what about anti-heroes? What do you do with that? Cowboys and Indians, cops and robbers? My pal Megan grew up in San Diego, and they used to play Mexicans in Border Patrol at age 8. Megan grew up fine. She doesn't have a scrap of racism in her heart. How does one navigate this as a child and as an adult? Now, what about the Homeland Security play school sets where they have a toy inspection station where you can walk your play school dolly through a metal detector? And there's a play Homeland Security doll, too. Homeland Security officer. There was a great Swedish movie called Togetherness, I think it was, where there's a mainstream woman who moves into a leftist commune because her husband's an abusive drunk and she has nowhere else to go. And, of course, mayhem and hilarity ensues. And one of the most interesting moments is when her kid is playing with some of the commune's kids. And what they're playing is Pinochet and revolutionaries. And the kid playing Pinochet is shouting, "Confess! Confess!" While the little revolutionary kid says, "Never!" So what happens next? Does the victim kid jump off of a couch, the equivalent of being shot and thrown out of a Chilean Air Force plane over the ocean? Or does the victim kid escape, round up some comrades, and start a revolution using military discipline and ideals? The conflict paradigm goes deep. Pacifism is only one tool in the toolbox to resist conflict. Sometimes opposing force is required. The idealism and virtues associated with good conflict versus bad conflict are deeply entangled. Look at the Oakland Police Department and its relationship with the community, ostensibly to serve and protect. And the complexity around issues like Chauncey Bailey and the whole relationship with the police and the perpetrators of the murder. Very hard to identify absolutist answers to that mess when there's so many heroes and villains on both sides of the coin. I don't have any answers. I'm no authority on this stuff. I'm just a media and culture producer who started a DIY nonprofit. That's all. Like the militaristic use of force for a specific purpose, however, media and culture are also tools for transforming a society and could be put to very good and also profoundly evil uses. So the first question seems like it needs to be about intent and idealism and virtue and the consequences of interpreting and implementing those ideals and virtues on the ground. It's the difference between theory and practice and the ability of a media culture to sustain open and substantive discourse on those topics. So in closing, the only thing I know for sure is that closed, non-discursive media cultures become propagandistic. which is the ultimate enabler of slaughter in and by a democracy. And if there is any worthwhile focus of the energies here regarding media and culture, it is to create an open media culture that is by its nature antagonistic to propaganda in all its forms.
All right, so hopefully those three different topics that we talked about will give people a good idea of which topic they want to explore in the breakout sections. Again, we do ask that folks, if they can, specifically focus on one of those three. If you look around the room, there's a post-it paper with the titles of each of them. Back to your back left is police and immigration. That's to your right. Right. Back to your right is police and immigration. Back to your left is corporate war profiteering. And up here by the exit doors is art, culture, and everyday life. So the idea is if people can focus specifically on one of those, then it's going to help those discussions be more fruitful.